Well, I'm upstairs the other day, trying on my sister's cords, when a man come knocking on the door from the electric board. Well, I thought about letting him in, but I wasn't thinking fast. He'd only been there half an hour when he barged his way right past. I said, "Oi, mush, fuck off. Who do you think you are? Don't you talk to me like that, I'll do your fucking car." I said, "Oi, mush, fuck off. Who do you think you are? Don't you talk to me like that, I'll do your fucking car. Oi!" Standing there picking up my teeth when the landlord comes around. "Oi, you little bastard," he says, "you owe me £40. He pins me up against the wall and he tries to snatch my gyro. So I kicked the fucker in the balls and stabbed him with my biro. I said, "Oi, mush, fuck off. Who do you think you are? Don't you talk to me like that, I'll do your fucking car." I said, "Oi, mush, fuck off. Who do you think you are? You money-grabbing bastard, I'll do your fucking car. Oi!" You'll never guess what happens next. Oh, shit. Right then, Dibble's at the door, waving all their truncheons. They tried to pin me to the floor, so I fucking upped and punched one. Then they took me down the station, and they questioned me for hours. And one said, "Oh, just look at you, they'll love you in the showers." I said, "Oi, mush, fuck off. Who do you think you are? Incinerating things like that, I'll torch your fucking car." I said, "Oi, mush, fuck off." He said, "Don't talk to me like that." So I stuck the fucking head in and said, "Well, handcuff that, you twat. Oi!" Right, now the moral of the story, ladies and gentlemen. Please hang on to your seats. That's why I'm in strange ways, doing a stretch of bird. Judge called on me to change my ways, and I called him a turd. "I'll do my time standing on my head, you haven't got me beat." He said, "Well, have another fucking year and then get on your feet." I said, "Oi, mush, fuck off. Who do you think you are? Don't you sentence me like that, I'll do your fucking car." I said, "Oi, mush, fuck off. Who do you think you are? You big fat wigged up bastard, I'll do your fucking car." I said, "You big fat wigged up bastard, I'll do your fucking car." I said, "You big fat wigged up bastard, I'll do your fucking car."
Cool.
How's it going? Welcome
to
the
swear words.
Yeah.
Naughty words, man.
Naughty words. Twat was my personal favourite. Turd.
Turd.
That's another good one. You were listening to Distant Island, November 4th, episode 92, I believe. So we got there was a rather depressing tone set in there.
Well, it does kind of, you know, reflect the sober tones of the week, I think, you know.
You're right, dude. It's been raining all week.
I know, yeah.
And it's the week the clocks go back. Everyone is traditionally more depressed in that week because your body clock gets a bit like... I came out of work the other day and it was like dark and rainy. It was like, what the fuck? You know, everyone gets a bit down.
Yeah, but like, you've lived here for X amount of years. Why are you surprised?
It's a recorded phenomenon.
Yeah, sad. But there's been other things getting you down, Bryn.
Well, yeah, we had the unveiling of Clause 26, which is a kind of, you know, pretty much like class war at its most defined. I think, you know.
Could you be more specific?
I think we will be later.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. There's plenty of interviews coming up on this subject, so check it out.
We've also got audio from the Anarchist Book Fair, the London Anarchist Forum, talking about consensus at the Anarchist Book Fair. I don't know if it's that's where they were talking about it or if they're talking about consensus there, but we'll find that out as well.
Do you reckon we'll be able to hear the jazz hands?
Maybe.
Cool. Someone's come in from Grow Heathrow as well. Let us know what they're up to, what's going on with them.
And we have the first of a three-part series on the Anti-Klaken. I think that's how it's pronounced, man.
Yeah, that's a good Dutch accent, dude.
It's just someone laughed over there, so...
Maybe it was my genuine accent. I'm still thinking about a giant squid.
I always think of Release the Kraken myself when I hear that. Like.
The Kraken awaits, but there you go.
There you go.
Right, so what have we got on first?
We got the London Anarchist Forum from last week's...
2 weeks ago now?
Well, yeah.
Tudder Week.
Yeah.
The Anarchist Forum has been inactive for over a year now. Its last large meeting was at the 2009 Book Fair 2 years ago. But we did hold regular meetings more or less every year at the Anarchist Book Fair before that. And at our height, about 10 years ago, we were meeting weekly at Conway Hall. Hopefully this meeting will be the first of a new series of Anarchist Forum meetings that will hopefully get more grounded in spring, in case we have a heavy winter or something. But there may be a few meetings in winter. A lot of people, me included, got their first experience of anarchism at the London Anarchist Forum. And for me, what was special about the London Anarchist Forum was that it was a completely informal group. There was no chairperson. There was no membership as such, and there was no overall agenda. It was just a diverse range of anarchists and just members of the public who we used to advertise in Time Out as well, who just wanted to come talk about anarchist ideas in a very informal sort of social setting. Some of us had been to anarchist meetings that are a little bit perhaps more Marxist in their organisation and are a bit more structured and sometimes quite oppressive in their in the way they kind of formed a kind of group consensus. But we felt if there was going to be a consensus, it had to be more of a natural development and something that would actually come out from people actually talking to each other as individuals and getting a better understanding of each other rather than trying to form some kind of an artificial collective. The first topic here would be on just that, unstructured anarchism and consensus forming in a very kind of like loose, informal way, which I think is the best way of doing it. And obviously, consensus decision making is obviously the thing now. It seems like the Ignacos and the and what's going on with the Occupy groups. Obviously, these are all sort of like consensus based organisations, and this is all gatherings, and this is this is how people want to organise. But there are there are problems with unstructured groups, and one of the one of the early critics of unstructured groups was someone called Joe Freeman in the 1970s, who wrote a booklet called, or an essay called, The Tyranny of Structurelessness. And the tyranny of structurelessness turned people off unstructured informal groups quite a lot and led to the anarchist movement. Originally, this was a feminist idea, but Joe Freeman wasn't an anarchist, she was a feminist, it's important to say. And her essay was geared to feminist discussion groups and feminist activist groups. But this quite caught on with the anarchist movement, and some of her criticisms were seen as valid by anarchists, and anarchists tended to make a kind of a more structured organisation after that, and it tended to become, in some groups, tended to become quite bureaucratic and quite organised in their in the way they form groups. And I've always felt that that was kind of like a negative development, because I think that kind of, although it's a good way of forming a cohesive group, it's actually quite a bad way of forming a kind of lasting consensus. It's almost like a forced consensus, and it can be quite stifling at times, I've found, when I've attended such meetings. So I've always been a champion of unstructured informal organisation. A lot of the problems people get with a consensus, informal consensus decision making, is if you have a large assembly of people, is I think it's better to form into very small affinity groups of like-minded people who have a kind of more of an ethic of consensus decision-making rather than forming any rules. And for a larger assemblies, all you really need is a kind of confederation of these small affinity groups and have sort of delegates from these small affinity groups, or even just have, you know, absolute communication on the internet or something so that everyone knows what everyone else is doing. And you don't really need a big diverse group. You can just work quite well with a small group of affinity groups, you know, working in collaboration and in communication with each other.
I guess the reason that pamphlet was written in the first place was because in a lot of groups, what happened, as you know, was that you know, the more middle class or the more confident or the white, I know in here, for example, there was recently a meeting, or just now a meeting about white privilege, would kind of like automatically take over the groups, even though they were supposed to be equal. And so there's something about like what is the mechanism that also leads that to happen. And although I agree mostly with what Steve's saying, but I'm also interested in what are the kind of unconscious factors. It's like our unconscious hierarchies, how we have a social unconscious deep within us, and we tend to very easily, even if we've got very strong anarchist values, we very easily think, oh, this person knows what they're talking about, or that person has done more, you know, they've had more experience, or this person is a little bit more articulate. And I think that it's that kind of process that goes on in a lot of groups that we wanted so much to kind of, you know, like explore alternatives to. But it's like it's a real contradictory one. I'd be really want to hear what other people's experience is. Because on the one hand, we don't want to have like leaders as very strong. You don't want to have leaders, you don't want to have chairs, you don't want to have spokespeople too much, or even representatives. We're not looking for the old ways. But if you're going to create something completely new, which is what's happening now, and it's a tremendously exciting time in the world, really, these movements that are happening now, you also want to be aware of how deep those unconscious patterns of projection onto other people, you know, either looking up to people or looking down on people for one reason or another, and to kind of have a sort of structure doesn't have to be hierarchical, structure doesn't have to be oppressive, structure doesn't have to be dominating. You can have a kind of what I call a rhythmic structure, where you can have somebody maybe on one project taking a bit of a lead, but then when the project's over, they take a back seat. You can have the kind of idea of constant fluidity, so that nobody stays in charge for any length of time, or that you have situations where, you know, you actually agree, you have a talking stick, for example, is very popular these days, where you say that like, everybody has to hold this stick when they talk, you know, so that everybody's giving them attention. And that's a structure. That is actually a structure. It's saying we believe that everybody in this group is equal, so everyone's voice is equally valid, so you give them a stick. Now, that is a kind of structure, but it's just not a...
It doesn't have to be sort of like rigid, because you know, if someone's got something to say and someone's holding the stick, it's that important, then that person should be allowed to sort of intervene as well.
Absolutely.
So it's not sort of the rules rule you. The rules are just useful to what you want to do.
Exactly, and that's the main point, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what you know, anarchists have been learning to do from the Spanish Civil War onwards. Is like, how do we create rules together? It's not that we necessarily have no rules at all.
Yeah.
But it's like that there's a flexibility, minimal, and that it's context orientated, you know. And there's something kind of like sort of natural, hello, darling. There's something sort of natural about it. And I think we've got a lot to learn from babies. Because, you know, there's something about all of us have in our core something that's really, I believe anyway, this is kind of, I believe that's true, that at our core we have a sense of equality of the other. At our core, but it's just been buried over, you know. And when a little baby is there, they're not going to kind of think, oh, that person's superior, that person's inferior. It's just, are you? No. So, you know, it's like for some of us to get back to that, you know, that core of ourselves is also part of the process, so that we can, you know, really deeply respect the other without having these kind of rigid structures. But it's not necessarily structureless.
No, it's never structurelessness by definition.
Because, yeah. So many people are leaving. I wonder if it's because they were expecting something different.
Maybe should have checked. But
to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 p.m. GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more.
We jingle that bit of an explosion at the end as well, deadly stuff. So nice one for Eugenio for getting us that last piece. That was good to hear. There's plenty more stuff about the recordings from Yankus Book Fair up on London Indie Media
and on Catalyst Radio.
Catalyst audio on Catalyst Radio, and there's still plenty of video audio and like writings and stuff from the book fair going up onto London Indie Media, and probably Be the Media will have it as well. So you should check them out. But with us tonight we have a special guest star, Barry.
Hello.
Hey, Barry. And Barry's come on to talk to us a little bit about Grow Heathrow. So, Baz, can I call you Baz?
If you like, why not?
All right, cool. Baz. Do you want to tell us just...
maybe?
Sorry?
Bazza, when we get a bit more friendly.
A little later on, we'll work it up. So, do you want to tell us a bit about Grow Heathrow?
Yeah, Grow Heathrow is a squatted community garden, an old market garden site in the what would have been the path of the third runway. And it's part of the wider Transition Heathrow project, which is on the radical edge of the transition movement, and grew out of the movement against the third runway being built at Heathrow.
Cool. So it kind of started a short while after the climate camp.
Well, quite a while actually. The climate camp was 2007, and then just up the road in March 2010, so just over a year and a half ago now, we squatted Grow Heathrow for the first time, and it's been beautiful ever since.
Absolutely.
And two years ago. Almost exactly, we've a group of people who had been involved with Plain Stupid and the climate camp moved down to the area and started getting involved, really. And
cool. So it's in Sipson.
It's in Sipson.
Cool. And so what do you do there? What's, like, aside from living there, I mean, I've been there myself, it's an open space, so what sort of stuff goes on?
So we've got about half an acre, which is mostly covered by old market garden greenhouses that date just after the war. And behind it is probably about 10 acres of basically wild land. And in that space we do a lot of growing things, growing food. We've got a bike workshop, we fix bikes. We use it for living space, meeting space, community space in general. We try to make it a sort of a space where the local community can come together, meet each other, do some things that they might not have done from before, organise in ways that they might not have organised before, and generally create a bit of a hub of radical activity in the Heathrow villages.
I suppose you kind of touch on it by saying, like, using the word radical there. Do you feel that your presence has radicalised the area in that regard?
As far as it's gone so far, lots of people come down, participate, get involved with almost everything we do, and it's hard to tell how where that goes. Mm. But we know that there's more and more people getting involved with the things that we do, and we don't hide. you know, the kind of activities that we want to organise. We organise, help participate in actions against the airport when airport workers went on strike. We organised local people to go down and support the strike. Mm. We're constantly advocating, joining in different protests and direct actions that are going on around London, around the country. So by building that sort of local base at Grow Heathrow, we actually hopefully are contributing to wider political movements as well.
But from my impression, that the local people were quite radicalised already by the whole threat of their town being wiped out by the runway. I mean, do you think that you just parachuted in and you're radicalising them, or do you think you're joining in an already existing movement or tendency?
The local people were radicalised to an extent. They were by no means clearly organising lots of direct action against the airport. That really kicked in for them with the climate camp in 2007, when they realised that they were not alone and that there were people that had ways of doing things that they could join in with and, you know, directly participate in that were also effective. But the area itself is not a hotbed of radical activity, let's say. And so we're trying to broaden the ideas, you know, the energy that went against the airport, we're trying to broaden that out into wider social activity.
Cool. So, I mean, as it stands now, do you think, I mean, when you first went there as a collective or individuals who formed a collective, you must have had certain aims in what you wanted to achieve. And do you think that you've been able to further them and further your own causes? I mean, do you feel you've had successes there?
Yeah, I mean, I do. What were our aims? If I remember, we had three aims. So the first one was quite a traditional transition town type aim. It was, you know, the things you'd see in Totnes or you know, the various just transition towns around the country. And they were all about local people organising for themselves to build what they call community resilience, sustainability, local skills, local jobs, local connection to each other, such that in times of crises they can survive. And the crisis that transition really addresses itself to is peak oil and everything that comes with that. But to that we wanted to add community self-defence.
So is this the third aim?
Well, I'm on the second one, but I'll come to the third one because it's a bit different. Yeah, yeah. The community self-defense is the second one, and we wanted to bring in the skills of the environmental direct action movement for defending space, direct action in all its beautiful forms, to say, look, if you build this transition and, you know, sustainable community, you're going to need to be able to defend it when an airport decides it's going to tarmac over that, or when a big supermarket is going to set up right on the edge of your lovely transition town and wipe out all the local shops. You're going to need to fight that, and community self-defense is the way you do that. And that's what we wanted to bring to it. And the third one was transition justice for workers in high emissions industries, or just transition justice. And obviously, that one was important to us because the airport is the biggest workplace in Britain and one of the main direct or indirect employers for the area. So what happens to those jobs and those people's lives in a crash related to peak oil? Well, it needs to be directed by them. So that's why we support their strikes and try to create links with local workers' movements. To start hopefully creating a community empowerment to direct that situation themselves rather than that being dictated to them by the airport, cutting jobs or cutting pensions as we're seeing them trying to do.
So if they're the aims, putting back to the question.
Have we been successful? Yeah, well, I say in the first two, yes, very successful. Cool. We're really pushing those. In the third, it's been really tough. Mm. It's been really, really tough. And the biggest obstacle we found to trying to engage local workers is basically the trade union movement in the airport. It's a closed shop. They don't want anyone else to offer any kind of solidarity at all, lest they lose their grip on power. And in my opinion, they were very ineffective as a result, and have so far not done a very good job for their members.
Would you care to name and shame the union in question?
It's Unite the Union, the New Labour Union, and at the time of this particular dispute, New Labour were in power, and that's probably one of the main reasons they didn't really want to be too confrontational. However, I know we're in the world of coalition governments and Unite are
Torydom.
Torydom, Tory scum on our streets, and nowadays Unite seem to be getting a bit more feisty, but I wouldn't hold your breath.
Cool. So I suppose bringing it to the present time, do you want to just tell us what's going on for the very short future for you at the moment?
Yeah, so at the moment, at Grow Heathrow, the site, we are up in court. The owners want to evict us. We want to buy the site off them and set up the beginning of a community land trust. We want to do that so that we can start to make long-term plans for the site and hopefully start securing that space for the good of the community in perpetuity, rather than giving it back to the owners who previously polluted it, trashed it, and various other antisocial
activities. Have they got planning permission? I thought they just didn't have planning permission, right?
They've got no planning permission, but developers and people who make these kind of investments always think and probably know that eventually they can persuade some corrupt councillor to change its planning status if they grease enough palms.
Cool. So in 2 weeks you're in court.
On November the 17th we're in Uxbridge County Court, and everyone who wants to come and support is really, really welcome to come down. We're going to have a play put on by some local residents and people regularly involved in the site that I don't even know what it's going to be about, but it's going to be performed outside of court. I'm not in it. Let's be clear about that. So don't let that worry you. I won't be in it. We're going to be defending Grow Heathrow in every way we can. Every Wednesday we have Resistance Wednesdays, which is how we think about how we're going to stop them taking Grow Heathrow off of us.
Yeah.
And we've been building all kinds of beautiful towers and all sorts, really,
all sorts of
on shit. Resistance Wednesdays.
So last time you were in court, I mean, something happened which was fairly unprecedented, you know, certainly in my knowledge of squatting. I mean, what, you got like a year adjournment, am I right in saying? You know, that's pretty much, you know, through like public backing. Yeah, so that's, you know, you had like your MP on side, you had lots of community support. Mm-hmm. You know, can you see that happening again when you go out to court?
I think it's important for people to remember that court is not black and white. Like, no matter how much they pretend that they're just following the law as it's set down, you know, the political campaign that frames the court case will influence everything. And in our case, we can only assume that the judge took liking to our campaign, and through
was it the same the case, judge this time?
I don't think it is the same judge at this time. We're not sure actually who the judge is, but I can only assume that she deliberately threw it into some kind of bureaucratic court case labyrinth, and it came back a year later. So more than a year later. But that is also related to some bad moves by the owners themselves towards the court.
Cool. So if people want to find out more, come along. What is it, Resistance Wednesdays? How can they get in touch or find out about you?
Well, really, you can come along any time and visit, but regular things you can join in are Craftanoons on a Tuesday, Arts and Crafts, hey, Resistance Wednesdays, every Wednesday, all kinds of resistance shenanigans.
Resistance Wednesdays on Wednesdays.
Getting built. Yeah, anyone who wants to on a Wednesday, traditionally, anyone who wants to practice building resistance machines,
things,
anything you like, really, come down. Thursdays is a bike workshop, so you want to bring your bikes down, or if you want to come and help, join in the bike workshop. That's on Thursdays. And Sunday afternoons is our gardening club.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. So, well, thanks very much for coming on.
Pleasure.
And what's your website?
www.transitionheathrow.com.
Nice one. All right, well, thanks for coming in, and we'll no doubt hear from you again after the trial, if you'll come back.
Certainly will.
All right, nice one, Basmondo.
So here's a song just about you.
Member of Squash.
Hello.
Maybe you can start off by telling us a little bit about what Squash is and what Squash does.
Sure. So Squash is Squatters Action for Secure Homes, and it was actually originally founded in the 90s, so that was the last time a Tory government tried to criminalise squatting. A group of people just revived it when we became aware that the present Tory government were very keen to criminalise squatting. And yeah, so we reformed it, and we've been working since then to try and fight the criminalisation in a lot of different ways. So,
rewind about 6 months, this story wasn't in the media, you know, most people didn't care or didn't even know about it, and now it's basically being criminalised. Did you honestly think that would happen?
No, the timing of it has been astonishingly fast. It's caught everybody off guard. Basically, I think the Ministry of Justice realised that there was potentially going to be a huge outcry to criminalisation squatting, and they've sneaked it in via the back door. So
yeah,
2 weeks after the end of the consultation, they announced the results of the consultation, which actually said that 96% of respondents were opposed to criminalising squatting,
yeah,
including the police, the Magistrates Association, the Law Society, the Housing Law Practitioners Association, and so on. But anyway, the next day, they announced this last-minute clause to the Legal Aid Bill, which said essentially to make it criminal to squat in residential buildings. I mean, the government appear to be doing that purely as a kind of sop to what they think public opinion is. But it's also like this completely fabricated public opinion that's been created by the right-wing press,
yeah,
that's been created by right-wing Tory MPs. And I think that, you know, when you kind of look beyond that attempt to kind of satisfy a supposed public demand for the criminalisation of squatting, which is largely fictional, you just see a strengthening of property rights at a time of extreme economic stress and at a time when resources are becoming scarcer. And so they want to strengthen the ability of those that have resource to keep hold of their resource and not to let anybody else use it.
We are meant to live in some kind of democracy. I mean, if the government has like an open consultation, you know, to try and rally public opinion, and then the public opinion goes the other way, how can they just, you know, steamroll this bill ahead?
Yeah, it's completely astounding, and it completely highlights for me how limited the supposed democracy that we live in actually is.
Mm.
You know, how can you have 4 working days between the announcement of this new clause to criminalise squatting,
yeah,
and when it gets voted through the House of Commons? So it's, you know, it was introduced into this bill that's already at its third reading. There's been no committee stage, there's been no scrutiny, there's been no kind of time for MPs or anybody else to get their heads around what the government have put out and just added to this existing bill.
I was listening to it live as it was going through, and one of the MPs like stood up and said amendments were made like less than 24 hours ago. How am I going to read all this stuff, you know, and make a clear and balanced decision? It's just a farce, no?
Yeah. And what's an even greater farce is that they put the debate in at between 8 and 10 in the evening. Mm. The chamber was pretty much empty. But what the MPs do is they hang out in the bar whilst the debate's going on, and they come in to vote when it's voting time. And what they do is they just follow their party line. They follow the whip. What was incredibly distressing about watching the debate for me was that you saw Andy Slaughter, who's the Shadow Justice Minister, so Labour Shadow Justice Minister. And his speech was actually really interesting because he was ripping the bill to the amendment to criminalise squatting to pieces.
Yeah.
Like he was just reeling out all of the kind of like major arguments against it, and then at the end he's like, oh yeah, but of course my party is going to be supporting this criminalisation, and we're leaving it up to the House of Lords to make sure that a lot of these problems are solved. And of course Labour put a whip on it, but you just look at the number of people that oppose, the number of MPs that oppose the bill, it's absolutely clear.
So what, were Labour was for it as well?
The Labour Party put a whip, and Labour MPs voted for the criminalisation of squatting. They're playing a purely political game that's really disgusting, basically.
But anyway, now we have this clause like 26, and it basically, you know, it stipulates that residential property as opposed to industrial property, if you squat there, then it becomes a criminal offence.
Yeah.
Why do you think there's this kind of distinction between the two?
I think what they're doing is they're trying to appear to be striking some kind of compromise, because they were concerned that if they came right out and said, look, we're criminalising squatting in total, there'd be such a big outcry that they'd look ridiculous and it'd be difficult for them to push it through. So I think they're trying to appear reasonable and appearing to be like striking some kind of compromise. What Crispin Blunt said in the debate, and what kind of other Tory MPs have been saying, is that they aren't stopping here. Like this isn't the end of their attempt to criminalise squatting. It's going to go further. They want to criminalise all forms of squatting. They want to make it criminal in commercial properties as well as residential properties.
Yeah.
And I think that the reason why they restricted it as well in this first instance is because if they'd said commercial properties, then that would have implicated student occupations, workplace occupations, and I think that's a fight that they weren't quite ready for yet, but is a fight that they're going to pick once they think that they've divided people enough. You know?
By criminalising the residential properties, it affects all the kind of the families who are getting kicked out, tenants. I mean, surely that it affects so much more people than if they do the other way, surely.
Yeah, that's true. It does. And it's, I think, also to do with this kind of constructed public opinion that they've made. So by saying residential properties, they say that they're helping that homeowner who's been displaced by squatters. Mm. But obviously they're not, because it's already a criminal offence to displace someone from their home by squatting it. So they're not actually doing anything to tighten up that. They're just extending the criminalisation to all empty properties, properties that aren't being used by those that own them.
And then, of course, you have the massive problem. What the hell is a residential property?
Absolutely. So it's, I mean, this is another, like, really worrying element of what they've just pushed through, which is that residential has absolutely no clear definition. It says, you know, anything that's intended or adapted for living in. So you can imagine a situation in which, like, you know, some huge empty warehouse, somebody's gone and put a bed, a table and a chair in it, and there we go, it's adapted for living in.
And surely it's adapted by you squatting and living in it.
Exactly.
So
what we are going to hope for now is that, obviously, like, this isn't law yet, it hasn't come into law yet, it has to go through the House of Lords. And if there's anything that the House of Lords do, it's rip apart vague legal kind of definitions. So there is hope to actually pressure the Lords in a way that means that they're going to tighten up these kinds of definitions, and there's like various things that we can try and push for. So especially removing like the retrospective application, so for those that are squatting already, not to be in residential properties, not to be criminalised. Like, it's actually counter to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to bring in like retrospective criminalisation.
That's all a bit academic when all this kind of relies on the police understanding and knowing the law. And if it's a case of them standing outside your building trying to figure out whether it's this or that.
Mm-hmm. It's really, really awful. And like that, I think that's one of the scariest parts of this, is that it is putting the police in an incredibly empowered position. It also, like you mentioned before, tenants, like, it's potentially putting the most vulnerable tenants in an incredibly dodgy situation. So if they're faced with some horrible landlord that wants to get them out quickly, turn around and say, actually, they're a squatter, like, basically, who's going to decide that now? It's going to be the police on the doorstep. And even if later, but via some kind of criminal proceedings, it's too late. You've already lost your home.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. If you are a tenant, no fucking legal aid anymore. Yeah. So, you know, you can't sue your landlord. So.
No, it's a mess. It's a total mess. I think that there is a lot of room here to build, like, a squatters movement and to build solidarity between squatters, to build, like, our internal infrastructure, to, like, really figure out ways that we can support each other. Like, once this comes in fully, there's going to be a whole load of test cases. And we have to figure out a way that we can do that together, and we can do that maybe en masse, we can do that in solidarity, and we can do it in a way that's good for squatters.
So we now have this law coming in, so what's going to be the punishment if you know you're caught?
It's difficult to say what it'll actually be, because there's no doubt that this is going to change as it goes through the Lords.
Right.
But at the moment, what's been kind of added to the bill in the House of Commons is that if you're in a building as a trespasser and you intend to live there, or you are living there, then it's a criminal offence. It doesn't say anything really about visitors. Mm. So if you're not intending to live there, or you aren't living there at the moment, it's not a criminal offence. It's so badly written, because literally they wrote it in a couple of days on the back of an envelope.
Yeah, with a biro, no doubt.
Yeah. You know. And in terms of punishments at the moment, what it is a year in prison, and or £5,000 fine. I thought it was quite interesting in the debate, I can't remember who it was, maybe Jeremy Corbyn, but he raised this thing about squatting occurring in times of social stress, and he basically asked the question, where are people going to go? Mm-hmm. And with this, if it stays the same, it's like, well, people are going to go to prison. That's disastrous.
Worst comes to worst, I mean, what timescale are we looking at? They really do rush it through.
So I think, again, it's hard to say, but my estimate is a couple of weeks before it goes to the Lords, and then
so soon
so that's why it's really important that we just keep fighting hard for the next little while. A really, really important message to send out is that it's not law yet, and there's still stuff we can do to fight it becoming law. And even once it's passed through the House of Lords, it has to go back to the Commons, and after that then there has to be guidance written to the police and to the courts. So it's still going to be a while until it comes fully into law. So yeah, build the movement.
I was reading one article which basically said there was fear about getting this through the Lords, because some hikers who were seeking refuge in empty buildings because of the rain would then be like committing a crime.
Somebody at a meeting last night raised exactly that issue and said that they thought that's the issue that the Lords are really going to pick up on, that's the thing they're going to pull to pieces, and that's the kind of thing they're going to focus in on. But in some ways, the hiker and the person who has no other option but to sleep on the streets aren't very different.
Yeah.
You know? And if we can bring those connections, then maybe that's quite an interesting exercise, and like quite an interesting way to like say to people, like wider outside of the House of Lords as well, it's like, well, why can you think it's ridiculous for a girl guide to be criminalised when she takes shelter from the rain in the Scottish Highlands, but it's not ridiculous for somebody who would otherwise be sleeping on the streets to take shelter in an empty building that the owner doesn't give a shit about, it's not being used. But yeah, come to Squatastic on Sunday.
I guess it will be released on the Squash website, which is
www.squashcampaign.org.
Excellent.
And Squatastic.blogspot.
Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Cool, thanks for having me.
See you later.
You're listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Oh yeah.
www.dissidentisland.org.
You are listening to part one.
of a series of live talks, exploring the rise of the anti-crack in the Netherlands, and the eventual criminalization of the squatting movement. Part 1 will cover the rise of squatting in the 60s, long before the squatting ban in Holland came into effect.
First, I'm going to tell you a tiny bit of squat history because I think it's very relevant for us these days, and it's also very relevant for how the Dutch situation ended up. So yeah, we all know this kind of really epic images of like the 80s and the 60s where there were thousands and thousands of squatters in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam alone, and there were these huge riots and they had a lot of power, but how did this movement get actually so successful? And this kind of, the basis for that is really in the 1960s already, where you have this combination of the huge housing shortage in the Netherlands, mostly because of demographic circumstances, a lot of young people looking for a place, and Holland was a really conservative country, so you even had to be married to even get, you know, to be on the list for social housing, for example. This combined with the fact that politicians and mayors all over the country thought it was a really neat plan to do some redevelopment in the city and want to demolish all kind of housing blocks and make this really shiny concrete office blocks there. That resulted in a lot of empty houses because they wanted to demolish these neighborhoods and started to kick people out slowly. And a lot of people looking for a house. Of course, a very shitty situation for a livable city, but the ideal situation for squatting to kick off. It doesn't mean necessarily, of course, that I would start this movement. I mean, there were people clandestinely going into houses and squatting there, like this couple in 1965, which is now seen as the first squatting action, but it's only the first squatting action because the media got a hold of it and they published a lot about it, and then the result of that was that a lot more people came there to squat because they read it in the newspaper that there were a lot of empty houses and that you could squat it, even though the word for it, kraak, as we have in Holland, didn't exist yet. Like from this time on, people kind of did it sometimes. They also knew about this table bed chair thing, and some of you might have heard of this. There's this ancient law in the Netherlands, or there was, if you go to an empty house or building and you put a table, bed and chair there, then you have some kind of protection from eviction. It's called house peace or domestic peace. They can't just evict you. So this was also what made squatting legally possible. Still, of course, the police evicted people a lot of times and you know, it was contested a lot in court, and people really had to fight for this to also make it stand. Then there's this certain neighborhood where there's a lot of protests against the demolishment of their neighborhood, and somebody comes up with the idea to start to make squatting like a means of action to say in this whole protest of the neighborhood. And a lot of people like the idea, so they start to promote squatting more. They start this official kind of sounding institute called the Housing Agency, the Kraker. Also they write this squat manual, which explains people how to go about it. For example, that it's smart to do it during a popular television program, so people will be watching television. And this is 1969 when this first squat manual was published. But it's also quite radical from the start. This is also like it's anarchists involved with this. So they also kind of really promote to get self-organized, to organize protests with the neighborhood, to not trust political parties. It says in the squat manual, do not trust any political parties, official institutions, especially not the communists, because they will just hijack your neighborhood protests for their party goal. So do it yourself, and in the end, this specific group in this neighborhood saved a huge part of the neighborhood from demolition. So this was a great success, and in the process of that, they also promoted squatting. More and more people realized it was an option, and they set up a movement infrastructure, which was also of very lethal importance. for this movement to arise. For example, because often the houses in this specific neighborhood were in a very poor state, so they started this fund where every squatter would put in a little bit of money, and then they could use that fund to repair the houses collectively and also for collective actions. So in the beginning this was all practical stuff, and in the end it grew out to what some call a city within a city, from a vegetables shop to a daycare to a squat bar to theater. Everything was there. You didn't need to live this kind of squatted city. And also an important part of this well-organized squat infrastructure that was set up, what you call, I think, practical squatting evenings, where you have this information hours where people can come to and get help with squatting and how it works if people break on the door. And this is also what still exists today, of course, since there's not as many squats anymore as back then, since the situation changed completely. We don't have this whole infrastructure anymore, but we have parts of it, which is, for example, this squat information, which is still organized. In Amsterdam, you have different squat informations organized per neighborhood. And if you would want to squat an empty lot in that neighborhood, you can go there, and the people would help you out with like, figuring out if the building was empty for a year or longer, because that was one of the restrictions they made later. So this is a lot of paperwork and hassle and annoyance. Also, people would be there that have a bit more experience in breaking open the door without causing too much damage, which is quite helpful if you want to be able to use the door later. And also know more about barricading, the legal situation, maybe help you talk to the cops, because that's a very interesting part of the Dutch squatting before the ban, which was always very nice. If I had visitors from other countries, then you would take them to a squatting action, which was usually every Sunday. It was mobilized with the small notes that would go around, like the squat sign, and then 2 o'clock, there and there, assembly, then you would go squatting. And then if everything succeeded, table, bed, chair in squats, and then you would call the police. This is something ridiculous, of course, but this is because of the strange, semi-institutionalized situation of squatting in the Netherlands, that if you would report the squat at the police, you also would have their word that it was actually empty. They came to check, like, okay, is it actually not in use? So later, if the owner tried to fuck you over and said, like, no, but you know, I had all this expensive stuff there and I was really using it, then the police had also witnessed that this was not true. So he couldn't come up with this bullshit. So it was something that was, like, for us, it was a kind of good situation to do. Have 2 cops inside, check the building, and it would be really weird for like visitors, for example, from the United States or wherever, that's like, you call the cops? It's like, and then the cops are like, hey, hello, it's a nice day. Oh yeah, that's a really nice lot you squatted there. Yeah, I would like to live here. And then they would check the house, and then they would leave, like, yeah, good luck, bye-bye. Of course, they also cause trouble. But sometimes it went like this, and sometimes they cause a bit more trouble, but most of the time, in Amsterdam at least, this is how it went. So that was the result of all this like fighting and hard work of this squatting movement from the 60s on, throughout the whole 70s and 80s, where people really organized infrastructure, did community organizing together with the neighborhood, did shitloads of campaigning, a lot of like awareness putting there, that we had this, in combination with the law and strange Dutch politics, that we had this kind of established movement.
Tune in next time to hear part 2, which will talk about the first attempts to criminalize squatting, and the rise of the anti-crack corporations.
Je pense à toi au petit soir.
Francais. So that song goes out to Occupy France, which started today.
Yeah, dude, there's like 1,000 people.
There's like over 1,000 people, but they've been having some trouble with the riot cops, and apparently the riot cops rushed in and stole all their tents. So apparently,
fucking hell,
it's not a laughing matter. There's 1,000 people. They've got 26 tents left between 1,000 people. It's gonna be cozy tonight, man.
They love that.
Well, stole their tents.
I don't think it was a laughing matter. To be fair, like from the reports coming in, but
no, yeah. It doesn't sound great. But are there a load of like gendarmes got off with their family camping now, like or what?
I don't know what you just said, but yeah. Cool, nice one.
Cool.
I fail French. Anyway, we're also doing a big shout out to all the people who got nicked the other day.
Yeah, there were 17 people that were nicked on the anti-squat ban action in London. There was also a action in Manchester. Shout out to them.
Woo!
And the 17 people who, most of which were arrested for an illegal protest under SOCPA, which is kind of bullshit because
it was
you
a
have
picnic.
To... Well, because it was a picnic, and also even if we wanted to have a legal protest, you need 7 days to ask the police to have one with 7 days' notice. And we weren't given 7 days' notice about them trying to ban squatting, so it would have been impossible anyway. Oi oi to democracy, hey. So those 17 people are going to be in court on the 11th of November. Come down to Westminster Magistrates Court to support them.
Is that the one on Horse Ferry Road?
No, they've moved. They're now Marylebone.
181 Marylebone?
Something like that.
You know, I heard someone got nicked for carrying an offensive weapon. They were a cyclist and they got nicked for having, like, you know, their bicycle lock, which is fucking ridiculous, man.
Yeah. I don't think it'll
You sound surprised, though.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's bull.
Yeah. Well, big shout out to all them. Hopefully it'll turn out to be nothing and they can get loads of money from the cops and that'll be early.
Woohoo!
Then I have a whole plan. Then they can invest in like a land trust somewhere.
But where?
But where?
So tomorrow we got a... Dale Farham Traveller Solidarity meeting, which is kind of about moving on from the whole Dale Farham movement to broader Traveller Solidarity. So there's going to be discussions about activities and actions that they want to plan, traveller education, legal support and monitoring, advocacy direct action. So that is in Cityside House on 40 Adler Street. London E11EE. The 9th of November is going to be a busy, busy day if you're a builder or a student.
Unlike most days, yeah.
Most days, yeah. Sitting around drinking tea, whistling at women,
reading a paper.
Yeah. So.
Is that students?
Yeah, take your pick, man.
So there's an open invitation to all building workers from London, which is just walkouts from sites and site close downs, centering around.
Is that a good time to go and nick some copper, do you reckon? Like,
I reckon, you know, if you had some friends and they could tell you where they weren't going to be and where the copper might be, yeah, maybe, but. Let's keep it clean, Bryn.
Oh, it was hypothetical.
No, it was completely hypothetical. Yeah. So this is all about basically there's five big electrical firms who want to cut electricians' wages by 35%, which is against an agreement that they made with them. I think it was last year. So on 9th of November, they're going to shut down big building sites in London. The main gathering is at. Liverpool Street at 7 a.m. Pinnacle House on Bishopsgate, and then there's another gathering at 11:30 at the Shard near London Bridge, and then there's going to be a rally at Blackfriars Station, which is also a building site, from 1 to 1:30, and then there's going to be marches down to the House of Commons for a lobby of Parliament.
Sorry, dude, I wasn't listening. What union is calling this?
Well, you can download the podcast, man. It's
we have a podcast?
We do, yeah. Download it on www.distantisland.org.
Okay, I will.
Sweet.
Or why not listening on catalystradio.org?
Yeah, why not?
Improv jingle.
No, this is Unite are mainly organising it. They are organising actually coaches to come down.
Did we not hear something bad about Unite earlier?
Yeah, I know.
What?
Well, you know, let's not tar them all with the same brush.
But they're all Unite, no?
Well, yeah, but Unite is very complicated.
It's a self-defined brush.
Are these the Tory scum or the Labour scum? Which scum are we talking about?
Unite aren't... I wouldn't apply the label scum to them. Unite are very... It's a very complicated organisation because they're basically like two very big unions came together to form one very big union and...
Like a multinational conglomerate of unions.
Mergers and acquisitions, but there's different tendencies within the unions. And obviously the Sparks...
In the boardroom, like...
Yeah, maybe. But the Sparks are kind of quite up for it. And they're basically using Unite to agitate for grassroots organising, which is how everyone should use their union. If you let the kind of corporate union dominate, then you'll get what you've had in Heathrow or wherever. But Unite, UKAT and GMB all support the Day of Action. Now the students, the National Campaign Against Fees and Cuts, as well as the main students' unions in the UK, are holding a march on the 9th as well, which is going to start from ULU, the University of London Union, at 12 noon, and then it will go into the belly of the beast in the city. They've released their route, which you can view on London Indie Media and various other sites.
Cool. I've nothing so heavy as that. Big up G, big up to Neil, big up to Aggers.
And the Yangster.
And?
The Yangster.
The Yangster.
Yeah, don't worry about it, man.
Cool. Right, cool. Yeah, Eugenio and Adam.
He's making up he has friends, mate.
Yeah, no, I know. He's fuck you.
As usual. Shut up, you. So, anyway, so big shout out to everyone. And I just wanted to say that there's a banging party happening on November the 12th. What?
No, that was a big one. That was a what?
Oh, that was a what? Yeah. You should know.
Okay, sorry.
We should say that Bryn was up before noon today, so he's a bit cantankerous.
He is indeed. Sleep deprivation, man. So, Dissident Dog is happening on November the 12th at a location to be announced later. We've got loads of cool people. We've got Tapes, Hooja Fink, Buster, Megabitch, 10 Foot, who is in the studio tonight. He's going to play us some tunes, and as we've got usual other sort of random DJs like Dissident Island DJs and such like.
Mm-hmm. Have your pens at the ready. Call 07570-189-222 on the night for the location. Check out, there's a page on London Indie Media, and I believe that it'll be up on our website soon enough as well.
Oh, yeah. Was I supposed to do that?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, it'll be up on the website soon.
Sweet.
So, 10 Foot, yo, do you want to take us away?
Yeah. Let's see if it's working. This one is a special request to all the little boys and girls in the world. Do it!
the owner of them. We walk and we talk with your love in our heart. We walk and we talk with your love in our heart. The woman wear the roach, so the man wear the clock. But when you see the boss, you got to bow and make the butt.
Now we bring you a roundup of today's news, read by the moon, the Mexican.
Who said I'm counting my chicken before they are? But they are golden chicken, the two. So what you gonna do, my friend? Cipriano, Cipriano, oh, you think I'm counting my chicken before they are hatched, huh? But they are golden chickens too.
Are not guilty.
Not guilty, I, Anna. I, Sylvester, don't deal with Chester.
Yeah.
that, look at that. You got to learn that. Got to party, yeah. Before you go to game. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling. I hear the children sing. I hear the children sing. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling. On the bench, some speak in French,
ooh, yeah.
Some talk in sense, oh yeah,
ooh, yeah.
Tell the teacher what you can, tell the teacher what you can. Sitting on the bench, some speaking French, some talking sense. Oh, yeah, got to learn it. M-A-T man, R-A-T rat, T-A-T cat, S-A-T sat. Look at that, look at that, look at that, look at that.
Up the strong side, the right side. Could you be the wrong side? I'm locked.
tell you, say, from you can avoid a white slip with the king, then you know you shall fall. We'll be right back.
is a love affair of us, baby. I couldn't let you walk around thinking it's all right to let me down. I remember
the way you used to love me.
Baby, I remember the way.
I remember the day you used to love me.
I gave you all my precious love and anything you want.
Feel the high of all that I despise.
grave. Have to lay it's better me. If I die before I wake, I hope the Lord don't hesitate. Get to hell, went through hell. Tell my babes all is well. And all them fools sold for sale, sitting next to death and hell. Demons scream in my head, on my head, on my bed. Let my heart, let my head. Fuck the slides, won't buy. Why is why? Till we fry. Watch the song, stand alive. Full slice of devil's pie. Drugs and thugs, when and why? Three or four at a time. Watch them all, stand alive. Full slice of devil's pie. Mainly greens, talk to this dish. Goes like this, here's the list. Materialistic, greed and lust. Jealousy, envious, bread dough, check cheese, lashes, dash, cash and cream, temperatures at high degree, niggas come to feast. Hell is this all about? Apocalypse, ain't no doubt. Everybody's holding out, all the loot, all the clout, right or wrong, we do or die, only vengeance can pacify. Watch your back, so will I, in these days and times.
The flow, the air with the beats, L in the rover. It's over, folks. Hold these.
The reason we hold things is no peace in the streets with the police in the streets. Yo, it's cops that all niggas dope for O's and keys. It's more than a beef with the 5-0 in the streets with the 5-0. It's a game of survival. And who protects me from you when I got peeps who rock texts and weed from you? And all a nigga see in the news is cop corruption. Niggas getting popped for nothing. And niggas getting stopped. The cops pull out blocks and bust them. Y'all need to get shot for nothing. Cause we don't hold back. We let go. We don't say damn. We just say whoa.
Shall I say, think back 22 years ago to keep it on track. The birth of a child on the 8th of October. A toast, but my granddaddy came sober. Count all the fingers and the toes. Now I suppose you hope the little black boy grows. 18 years younger than my mama. But I really got beaten with the girl of drama. In single parenthood, there I stood. By the time she was 21, had another one. This one's a girl, let's name her Pam. Same father as the first, but you don't give a damn. Irresponsible, plain not thinking. Papa said chill, but the brother keep winking. Still he won't down, you would tear out your hide. On your side while the baby make a slide. But mama got wise to the game. The youngest of 5 kids, hun, here it is. After 10 years without no spouse, mama's getting married in the house. Listen, positive over negative. For the woman, a master. Mother queen's rise in the chapter. Deja vu, tell you what I'm gonna do. When they reminisce over you, my God. Dig back, I recall a man off the family tree. My right hand, Papa Doc, I see. Woo. Took me from a boy to a man, so I always had a father when my biological didn't bother. Taking care of this, so who am I to pick up? Not a bad ticker, but I'm clocking Pop's liver. But you can never say that as life is through. 5 kids at 21, believe he got a right to. Here we go while I check the scene with the Portuguese lover at the age of 14. The same age, front page, no fuss. But I bet you all you know they live longer than us. Never been seen now, that's where you're wrong. But give the man a taste and he's gone. Not no sleep to a jazz tune. I can hear his head banging on the wall in the next room. I get the pillow and hope I don't wake him. For this man to cuss, hear it all in verbatim. Telling me how to raise my boy unless he's taking over. I said, Pop, maybe when you're older. We laughed all night about the hookers at the party. My old man standing yelling, good God almighty. Use your condom, take sips of the brew. When they reminisce over you, for real.
Tarifa. about so, ma'am. I'm endlessly proud of you. In such a short time span, you fill my heart and soul. From the big rock. Oh God.
what's up, my top boat, no, but then I'm about love. Top boat, no, but then I'm about love. Come again, top boat, no, but then I'm about love. Top boat, no, but then I'm about love. Everyone in the world, they must be love. So many ways that articulate are romantically. When you're in love, more time you're happy, especially when you love, I love your back badly. Now, when you're in love, make sure you're ready now, because your friend in love say you be falla ibiga, falla fashion love will die quickly. And if you love the person, body will hurt your badly. Me, I go tell you something. Who no listen to me? It's not hunger duty, make your love a lady. You have to check out her ways and personality. If she a cut your out, your uncle want your money. No, if a girl says she love your uncle, want your money. So take my advice and get rid of she, because a money grabbing girl with her. Take liberty, and in time to come, she will drive you crazy.